This morning we're going to celebrate the Lord's table. Jesus, and the night before he was betrayed, or the night he was betrayed, commanded his followers to do this on a regular basis until he returns. We believe that Jesus is coming back again, and until he comes back, until Jesus Christ, God, comes back to this earth physically, we will continue as the Church of Jesus Christ to observe the Lord's table. We've been doing it for 2,000 years. We will continue doing it until he returns. Paul repeated Christ's instructions, his admonitions concerning this, in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. And there he tells us that we are to remember Christ at this time, and that we're to reflect upon our Christian walk when we come to this, the Lord's table. In order that we might prepare our hearts for the Lord's table this morning, I've chosen to be in Hebrews chapter 12, and if you're not there already, I would encourage you to join me there. Hebrews is a grand book. The first word in the book is God. God, who at various times in various manners. It's likely a sermon that someone preached, at least if it's not a sermon that was preached on a regular circuit, it was a polemic that was prepared by somebody, the author of Hebrews. We often say when you're talking about Hebrews, because we're not sure who wrote it, but whoever wrote it very likely traveled with it and would present it as an argument to doctrinally arm and convince Jewish Christians of what they had in Christ. I believe there are two theses that converge and travel together alongside of each other in this book. The first can be expressed in three words: Jesus is better. Throughout the book, Jesus is better than Moses. Jesus is better than angels. Jesus is better than the Aaronic priesthood. Jesus himself is a better sacrifice. There's a secondary thesis that is going through this book, and perhaps it could be expressed best as the first of the five warnings, and there are five different warnings that form this thesis. And the first one is in chapter 2, where it says, How shall we escape if we neglect so great salvation? And so you have Jesus is better, and then alongside of that you have running this other thesis that how shall we escape if we neglect? By the time we come to chapter 12, these two theses, like light rays concentrated by a magnifying glass, have come together to form a powerful conclusion. The author is going to exhort us in these last two chapters to practice, because Jesus is better, because we have a great salvation that you ought not neglect, because these things are true and there's consequences of neglecting this salvation, because these things are true, therefore, how we live matters. And so we come to verse 1 where it says, therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, that's chapter 11, the hall of faith. No matter how you read chapter 11 into chapter 12, 1, as a literal they see it, or their witness, their lives are testimony to us, no matter how you interpret it, that's obviously what he's talking about in 12:1, where he says, we are surrounded by, like an amphitheater, by this cloud of witnesses, and they're encouraging us. Let us lay aside every weight, he says, and the sin which so easily besets us, ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. If Jesus is better than Moses or the angels or the Aaronic priesthood, then there are consequences of neglecting this great salvation. Therefore, we must lay aside anything that would drag us down from our Christ-like walk. H.A. Ironside pointed out that every individual, every one of us, has our own unique and different weights. Whatever Annika's weight is different than Megan's weight. You say, well, of course, they weigh differently. No, I mean, the things that would keep Annika from serving God are different than the things that would keep Megan from serving God. The things that would keep Beth from serving God are different than the things that would keep Bree from serving God. We all have our own unique weights, our temptations that come in our way, that keep us. And some of these things aren't necessarily sin. Your Christian walk may be disturbed by food. Someone else's Christian walk may be disturbed by anger. And in and of itself, these things may not be sinful, but when we succumb to them, when we succumb to the temptation of maybe too much food or responding improperly to people in our relationships, that's when sin comes. So he says, lay aside every weight. Get rid of these things that are weights and put them off. As an athlete, you don't need them. And then he says, lay aside the sin that so easily ensnares us. Sin always leads to confusion and slavery. Sin always leads to confusion and slavery. I am burdened when people come to me, and usually by the time a married couple comes to me for counseling, there is so much confusion. There's not always a right answer because they have so sinned against each other so many times that a right answer is often a very difficult thing to find. There is so much confusion. There is so much slavery. Every sin, lying, brings slavery and confusion. Stealing, greed, anger, bitterness, selfishness, pride, pornography, fornication, hatred, rebellion, laziness, apathy. These are all sin. And every single one of them confuses us, captivates us, keeps us from looking to Jesus, keeps us from doing what we ought to be doing. So Paul, as he's using this analogy here, we're in an amphitheater. We have this great cloud of witnesses who's watching us. Let us run with patience the race that's set before us. And in doing so, we got to lay aside every weight. We have to make sure that we stay away from the sin that would so easily captivate us. And then he says we should run with endurance. The Christian university is not a series of short Mickey Mouse classes. It takes endurance to run this race. It is not a sprint. It is a marathon. And many who drop out of the race prove by their actions that they never really were in the race. And so the author of Hebrews here acknowledges, you that are in this race, embrace the race. It's a long race. It's not an easy race. You have to run with endurance this race. If you would choose to be a Christian, if you would choose to run a Christ-like race, then you must stay away from the weights that are going to keep you from running it well. You must stay away from the sin that would ensnare you, that would trip you up. And you must do this with endurance. You must do this with perseverance. You must keep on keeping on that you might do this. And how? How do we run with endurance? And I think that's where my text verse, looking unto Jesus, shows up. In chapter 12, verse 2, it says, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. This is how we can run a long race. I've never run a long race. I think the last time I ran any length of time was probably soccer practice 148 years ago. I don't run anymore, much less a long race. But if you are going to run a long race, I've been told and I've read and I've heard testimony that sometimes there's a head game involved, a serious head game involved. You may think you're going to die one minute, and 10 minutes further down the race, there's something that changes. Maybe it's the topography. Maybe it's something that you hear. Maybe it's something that you think about. But that there's a mind game involved often in a long run or in a long race, in a long endurance. I know there's a mind game involved in life. You going to get up and do it today? You going to go to work today? Saw the Charlie Brown special this week. Lucy goes into Linus's bedroom to wake him up for school. And she says, Linus, it's time to get up to go to school. And he goes, again? I went yesterday. And it feels like that sometimes. What? Again? Again? We had set up a Christmas tree. It was a nice Christmas tree. Charlie had spent over an hour and a half decorating the tree. I woke up from my nap Friday afternoon and looked at that tree and I said, that is a beautiful tree. That might be the best Christmas tree we've ever had in our house. Later in the evening, we were playing games on the other side of the room and we watched the Christmas tree go, boosh. Next time we'll buy a Fraser, not a balsam. The trunk was too soft, I think. We were cleaning it up, Beth, Lynn, Charlie, and I. And as we're cleaning it up, I made the observation. I said, you know what? Nobody blamed anybody. Nobody yelled at anybody. Nobody expressed anger, although there was sadness. We lost some Christmas bulbs, the tree, the work that was done was lost. We live in a sinful world, and it takes endurance to run this race. Christmas trees fall down. That's minor. People die. People sin against you. You don't have to think back very far to figure out when was the last time somebody did something to you that wasn't nice. We hurt each other. We run out of stuff. There's not enough to satisfy our ever-empty soul in this life. And so we must run with endurance. How do you run with endurance? How do you stay away from sin? How do you keep on keeping on? How do you run this Christian? If we've got all these witnesses from chapter 11 watching us, then how do you run this race? And the answer is looking unto Jesus. When we receive Jesus, we look to him. The children of Israel were commanded to look and live in the story of the brass snake. Looking unto Jesus is trusting. Peter sank in the sea when he took his eyes off Jesus. Our prize in the Christian race is that Jesus is ahead of us to watch. That is our goal. That is our achievement. There need be no other recognition or reward. I note in my New King James that the hour, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, is italicized in my New King James. So it's applied by the translator that it would make sense. I don't think this is talking about my wishing or my hoping or even my intestinal fortitude, my courageousness. I think it's talking about the gospel here, that Jesus is the author and the finisher of our faith, that he's the one who started it. He's the one that facilitates it. He's the one that makes it happen. So we look to him. We trust in him. If we're going to have faith, if we're going to have a gospel, if we're going to have anything in this race, then we must look to Jesus. This race demands that we trust Christ, the Christ of the gospel. My thesis then, using the verse 1 as a springboard and thrusting us into verse 2, if we would continue to run the Christian race, we must look to, and that means trust and imitate, Jesus, the designer and facilitator of the gospel. And I see three things in the rest of verse 2, that looking unto Jesus first requires cross endurance. Cross endurance. Who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross. Sometimes in athletics, and Paul is obviously using an athletic word picture here. Sometimes in athletics we say, no pain, no gain. We understand in athletics the necessity of resistance. Cross endurance is an absolute necessity for spiritual growth. If you are not, I appreciated Beth's testimony this morning as I asked her how she knew she was a Christian. She said, because there's a struggle involved, because there's a fight involved. And that is one way to know your faith. If you are just giving in to whatever the flesh wants you to do, if you're just giving in to whatever is around you, then there's evidence that you're not a Christian. If you would be a Christian, you must endure the cross. And there's going to be some resistance. If you're going to mature, if you're going to grow up in Jesus Christ, there's going to be some work involved. Verse 3 says it this way, for consider him who endured such hostility from sinners against himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your soul. The hymn writer said it this way, is this vile world a friend of grace to help me unto God? And the answer comes back, no. The cross death was an agonizingly slow death. Again, the Christian race is not a sprint, it's a marathon. The long-distance runner has many opportunities to quit or trip up or get distracted. We must patiently endure the cross life. And one of the conundrums in this verse has always been to me that phrase where he says, who for the joy? That's a, you know, bring out the balloons, that's a happy word, right? Who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross. That is confusing. Using the picture of athletics, sometimes, we'll see it today if you watch any NFL football, there'll be one football player and another football player, and wham, there'll be a big hit, right? And usually the guy who's successful in the big hit isn't down very long. He pops up. Anybody who's played football knows that a good hit sometimes feels real good. We work out. Well, some of you work out. You work out, and when you're done, it's sore, but it's a good sore, right? It's a good sore. You go, yeah. Who for the joy that was set before him, the goal was so big that Christ endured. He did the cross, he did the hit, but it was because he had a goal in mind. And that goal in mind was to endure the cross for our benefit. And so when I deny Dan, you know, when I don't deny Dan, there's just, because I didn't do what I should do. But when I deny Dan's lustful thoughts, when I deny Dan's laziness, when I deny Dan's anger, when I deny Dan's selfishness, when I deny Dan's arrogance, when I deny those things in my life, it's work. But when I do so, afterwards, there's a, I got to be a little bit more like Jesus today because I kept my mouth shut. I got to be a little more what I ought to be today because I was reflective and thought a little bit, or I thought of somebody else when I push through, when I do what I ought to do in the name of Christ. Even in my Martha syndrome, when I do the right thing. Thesis: if we would continue to run the Christian race, we must look to Jesus, the designer and facilitator of the gospel. When you look to Jesus, that requires a cross endurance. I see secondly in this verse that looking to Jesus negates personal pride, embarrassment. He says, despising the shame. Despising the shame. As I read the passage that Rory assigned for me to read this morning in Isaiah 53, a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief. His visage was so marred. You wouldn't identify with that guy. David wrote it this way in Psalm 22, "But I am a worm and no man, a reproach of men and despised by the people. All those who see me ridicule me. They shoot out the lip, they shake the head, saying, 'He trusted in the Lord, let him rescue him. Let him deliver him, since he delights in him.'" 21st century Americans really have no concept, no picture of the cross. We don't understand the torture, the public shame, the suffering. If your very best friend or your husband, your dad, was nailed to a cross, it would be extremely difficult to embrace the cross. It would be extremely difficult to identify with that man. There would be people going by in the street yelling out cuss words at him. And you would defend that? There would be people going by in the street who would be throwing things, maybe stones or rotten fruit at him. He would be naked. Naked. They would be laughing, perhaps poking with a stick. There would be blood. No, it would be much easier to run. It would be much easier to just cover your face in shame and turn away than to identify with the one on the cross, to embrace the cross. And yet it says of Christ that because who for the joy of the cross life despised the shame. Despise the shame of Roman occupation, the shame of being in a country that's not ours, as we go to this other worldview that seems to become more and more prevalent in America today. I wonder if there's ever going to be a day where we will be shamed as Christians just because we don't have the right worldview. The shame of moral failure. The man on the cross, regardless of his innocence or guilt, was guilty. He was identified with. Jesus hung there between two thieves. He identified with sinners. And so if we would despise the shame of the cross, we wouldn't care what we were accused of. Our politically correct world is definitely trying to make criminals out of Christians. They think there's something perverted about our marriages because we believe that the Bible teaches that a husband has a responsibility to be a loving servant leader of his wife, and therefore they would accuse us of patriarchalness and chauvinism and abuse. No, sometimes when you identify with the cross, there's a certain shame despising that must be done. The shame of the torture and the abuse, the shame of being treated as less than human. Think of our country's cavalier attitude towards abortion. And I believe, as we're going to see in the years to come, there's going to be a growing euthanasia in our culture where people who have maybe cancer are despised. And we're going to have to despise that shame, despise the hate that comes from our culture that we might identify with Christ and do the right thing. The shame of loneliness, truly, the man on the cross was abandoned. Any wonder Jesus cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me? And so if we're going to despise the cross, or rather despise the shame of the cross, we must be willing to be alone. We must be willing to stand up and say, regardless of what happens, this is still my Christianity. This is what I'm going to do. The shame of the exposure, the nakedness, the shame of the helplessness, the weakness. Whatever the consequences, the shame of it all, it hits our self-worth. If we are trusting, if we are looking at Jesus, our self-orientated shames go away. If we would despise the shame, we would say, you know what, it doesn't matter. I'm going to look to Jesus, the author and finisher of my faith. I'm going to look to Jesus, and no matter what the cost of the cross, no matter what the shame that is directed at me from my culture, from my friends, from everything that's, from my own sin nature sometimes looks at me and goes, come on, get a life. You know, are you really going to do that? Wouldn't it be a whole lot more fun to do this? No, we're going to have to hate ourselves enough and look to Christ enough that we would despise the shame, that we would look at the shame and we'd go, is that all it is? Just embarrassment? That's what's going to keep me from serving Jesus and putting Jesus first in my life, is that I was embarrassed? Endured the cross. Despised the shame. Peter tells us that there's much good that comes from suffering as Jesus. If we would continue to run this Christian race, we must have reasons. We must have a cross endurance. We must neglect, get away, negate our personal pride and embarrassment. And finally this morning, you always like that, right, when I say finally? Finally this morning, looking unto Jesus sets our focus on eternity. He ends that verse, and it seems a little bit of a disjoint. He talks about the cross, the joy that was set before him, despising the shame. It's all extremely negative. And then it says about Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, he has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Wow, what a transferal. We go from the bottom of the bottoms, the cross, to the glory of heaven and the guy sitting on the throne. Wow, what a change. I think what we're supposed to see here is that this life is a temporary thing. Jesus despised the cross. He embraced the cross, rather. He despised the shame of the cross. He embraced the cross because he knew about heaven. Because he knew that the physical pain he was going to suffer. He knew that the negative attention that he would receive here, the shame of the cross, was all going to wash away. In light of eternity, in the presence of God, it doesn't really matter anymore. I think our eternal God looks down at temporal man. What does he see? As I thought a little bit about this this week, I thought of a conversation that Lynn and I had with a couple this summer. A couple in their early 50s, one kid, he's away at college, they're empty nesters, they're Christians. And we soon learned about this couple that they collect Legos. They collect Legos. Now, we have a tub of Legos or two in our basement. Sometimes, I think the last time they were played with, the Struska kids were over. They are from birthdays and Christmases past. Back in the day when every birthday, every Christmas, what do you want? Legos. So we have a lot of Legos in the basement. But this couple, they're not like the Legos that we have. Ours, by the way, are all torn apart. and maybe could never be put back together in their original condition because a piece is lost, but they made great forts and weird things that whatever was the imagination of Ezekiel, which was quite expansive. But this couple, this adult couple in their 50s, they collect Legos. They told us that they have rooms, plural, in their house designated for Lego building and Lego demonstrations. They anxiously wait. We get the Lego catalog because one time my wife signed up for it, so we get the Lego catalog when it comes out. They anxiously wait for whatever the next catalog, the next new designs and schemes, they know about them before they come out. They are members there in that fine American city of a Lego club where they get together and share ideas about Legos with other adult Lego enthusiasts. They go to Lego conventions. They actually get on airplanes and fly to other cities and spend nights in hotels so they can go to a convention to see Legos. The club that they're with in this fine American city, they go down to the city hall and into museums and into schools, and they build huge displays of Legos for people to pay money to come see. This man even told us that their obsession is so great that he got a part-time job at a Lego store so he could buy Legos at a discount. And as I listened to them, by the way, it's my cousin Craig and his wife Janet. I hope they never go to the website and listen to this. As I listened to them tell about their addiction to Legos, I said to myself, no, I didn't say to myself, I said it out loud, really? They were not embarrassed. I was incredulous to think how much time and money and passion they spent on Legos. I mean, the Lutherans and Catholics that I go to Kiwanis with, they have a desire to give back to their community, and yet my Baptist cousin spends his extra time on Legos. And I wanted to ask them, are there no elementary schools in your community that need someone to have children to read to the adult? Is there no cleaning schedule at your church for you to sign up for? Is there no food pantry in your community that needs help? Is there no one in your association that needs someone to listen to them? Have you really spent all the time you ought to serving God? And what if God came to visit their house? What would they show them? I think they would say, God, you got to see our Lego room. And I wonder, as I thought about that, what occupies center stage in my thoughts? Vacations? Vehicles? Second homes? Hunting? Sports? Family? Music? Sex? Entertainment? If God showed up today, in this moment, in this temporal setting, would we say, hey God, you should have heard what Gibbs said Tuesday night on NCIS. Is that what occupies me enough that that would be the first thing out of my mouth? I think sometimes God looks down at my life and sees what motivates me to action, sees what hinders me from my pursuit of godliness, sees my attractions to things that weigh me down, that might disqualify me from my Christian race, sees what turns my head from looking unto Jesus. And maybe God says, really? You are distracted by that? You have got to be kidding. This morning we come to the Lord's table, and at this Lord's table, we're supposed to consider Jesus. We're supposed to think about what he did for us in putting together the gospel. We're supposed to come here and evaluate our life in light of the gospel. That's what we're supposed to do according to 1 Corinthians 11 as we come to this. And I ask you from Hebrews 12, as we consider the eternal, what hinders you in your Christian walk? What's in your Lego room? What is bigger than it ought to be and replaces Jesus because it is bigger than it ought to be?